Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
I'm Lisa Held, a food journalist and podcast host, presenting Behind the Label with American Humane. Produced by Heritage Radio Network for Springer Mountain Farms, this podcast series dives into what the American Humane Certified Label really means. Subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Time for Lunch is a new podcast from HRN for curious young eaters, where we focus on the serious questions.
Aren't chickens tiny dinosaurs?
We get to know our favorite foods in unexpected ways.
We just like cheered like you would cheer for your classmate when they're rounding second base in softball. And we just like, peach, 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 peach. Yay, thank you, peaches.
Learn some new recipes and jokes.
What does a boxer's mom put in his lunch? A knuckle sandwich.
And load up on fun facts.
Experts estimate that there are between 1 and 2,000 types of insects eaten around the world.
So roll up your sleeves and dig in. Subscribe to Time for Lunch on your favorite podcast app so that you and your favorite young eater can catch up on the whole first season. New episodes of season 2 out each week.
Good evening and welcome to Eating Matters, where we talk about food systems and policy and how they impact all of us. I'm your host, Jenna Liute, and we're broadcasting on Heritage Radio Network. The murder of George Floyd back in May has sparked outrage and a broader national movement against institutional racism that still permeates nearly every aspect of our society today. We've talked a lot about issues of food justice on this show, but not as much about the environmental racism that affects so many low-income communities and people of color. And it's for this reason that I am really excited to welcome Dr. Fatima Sheffi to the show today. Fatima is an environmental justice expert who has dedicated her career to fighting to dismantle environmental racism, as well as educating the next generation on issues of sustainability and the need for equity in this space. She's currently an associate professor and chair of the Department of Political Science and the director of environmental studies at Spelman College. Fatima, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
Okay, so we'll start with the basics. Quite simply, what is environmental racism and environmental justice?
Okay, well, as Dr. Buller, the godfather of environmental justice, says, all communities are not created equal. So the environmental justice really expands the meaning of environment to include where we live, where we work, where we play, where we study, and what, where, and how we eat. And I think when you take that bigger picture of environment, then it's easier to conceptualize what is we're talking about when we talk about environmental justice. Environmental racism, as it's defined again by Dr. Bullard, is any policy, practice, or directive that differentially affects or disadvantage, doesn't matter whether it is intended or unintended, when it disadvantages individuals, groups, or communities based on their race or color. And what environmental justice is really a movement to stop environmental racism. And hopefully that is...
Yeah. So what are some examples of environmental racism? How do we see this play out and affect, disproportionately affect communities?
Okay. First of all, if you look at the movement that we call environmental justice movement to combat environmental racism, it is really the merging of three movements: environmental movement, economic social justice movement, and the civil rights movement. And environmental justice encompasses all of those areas. And if you look at the if I go back to what we call now today environmental justice movement, there are different start point that people use. Some go back to the W.E.B. Du Bois study in Philadelphia, the book Philadelphia Negro. That was the study that was commissioned by the University of Pennsylvania. And what happened is that he looked at the living condition and use the statistic and compare housing and then health of white community and black community. And one of the conclusion that he had was that we must really eliminate as much as possible the problem that would make a difference in health among people based on these criteria. But the modern environmental justice movement can some again go back to the Dr. Martin Luther King's visit to Memphis, Tennessee, because in February the sanitation workers striked in Memphis because of the working condition and also because it caused the death of the workers. So when he went there and he had that famous speech of "I have been to the mountaintop," that which he unfortunately was assassinated the next day, some used that as the start of environmental justice movement. And even though some others again used the 1982, where what happened in Warren County in North Carolina, where we saw that the community were trying to stop the siting of a landfill, PCB landfill. PCB is a it's a persistent organic pollutant that is carcinogen, and there are other other toxicity with it. If you go and look at the profile of the chemical, it's really not something you want. And when they decided on the site to really bury those contaminated soil with PCB in North Carolina, they came up with a Afton community, which is really was at the time 84% African American, and it was one of the counties that one of the municipality and cities that had the highest number of African American. And they decided to go ahead and put it there. At the time, there were demonstration against the siting, and civil rights leaders such as Benjamin Chavis, Walter Foundry, who was the U.S. Who was a delegate from Washington, D.C. in the U.S. House of Representatives, and other leaders, the Southern Christian Leadership and the LACP, they were all there, and they laid on the street to stop the truck, and they were arrested. Many of them were arrested. And the word environmental racism was coined in that Warren County incident. And what happened after is that, first of all, it was clear-cut case of racism, because the disposal site was only 15 feet above the water table, which is really the PCB, the usual requirement for landfill for PCB is 50 feet. So it wasn't really the science that they were trying to say this was the most suitable site for the landfill for PCB, because it really violated the basic requirement of the science. It's a distance from the water table. But it, nonetheless, it took place, and they put the landfill there. They arrested the protesters. And, of course, they had to go back again in 2000 and start the detoxification of the PCB landfill. And eventually, I think they got federal funding. But that's and another story.
Yeah, and that was in Warren County.
Yes, that was the same afternoon that they buried the PCB. They had to revisit it in 2000 because closeness to the water table, that so they had to go back and address some of the issues about that.
So you started saying the founding of the environmental justice movement could be traced back to W.E. Du Bois when he talked about the living conditions. Many, a century or so, more than a century ago?
Yes.
And then kind of fast forward 50 plus years, and you have Dr. Martin Luther King, who talked about the working conditions of the sanitation workers specifically. And then, so it addresses like living conditions, working conditions, and then another example would be the case in Warren County that addresses, proximity to toxic chemicals and addresses living conditions near landfill. Did I summarize that correctly?
That is correct.
Okay, and so it really is a very broad definition when we talk about the environment.
Yes. And what happened that was different in the Warren County, that is why everybody refers to Warren County as a watershed event in the movement, is because one of the people who participated in the protest was Walter Fountry. And during that protest, these civil rights leaders, they were asking, is it just coincidence that they are putting this PCB landfill in an African-American community, or there is more to it? Mm-hmm. Maybe this is not, is it an outlier, or is it really a pattern? So when Representative Fountry went back to Washington, he, among other members of U.S. House of Representatives, asked the General Accounting Office. That name has changed now. It's Government Accountability Office, but it's an investigating arm of U.S. Congress. They asked them to study to see if there is a pattern in siting of hazardous landfill. So the report came back in 1983, and the report really was very telling, as it concluded. The report name was Siting of Hazardous Landfills and Their Correlation with Racial and Economic Status of Surrounding Communities. So when they looked at the southeast, that was the area they were focusing on, the east, the area of the US EPA Region 4, which is the 8 southeast states. And when they looked at it, they found that 4 off-site commercial hazardous waste in that area really were, located in African American community. And even though African American community were only making up of 1/5, but there was a disproportionate number of those landfill, 4 out of 5 were located in the African American communities.
So when we talk about environmental justice and racism, to what extent is it a class issue versus a race issue? Is socioeconomic status a bigger indicator, for example, over race when looking at the community who is most impacted by these environmental issues?
Okay. That's a very good question, because that has been an issue that has been repeatedly being raised about. It's just economic. But if you look at, again, I'm going to take you back to 1987, because after that GAO study, which was only looking at the southeast of United States, then the United Church of Christ commissioned a nationwide studies to look at the relationship between toxic waste and race that mm-hmm. was published in 1987. And that was the first nationwide study to correlate waste and race, the citing of toxic waste and race. And what they concluded was that in 1987, that 15 million blacks, mm-hmm. 8 million Hispanics, 2 million Asian Pacific Islander, and 700,000 Native American live in communities, which means 3 out of 5 African American living communities that were close to toxic waste sites. And if you look at also the largest, the nation's largest hazardous waste landfill at the time that receives the waste from 45 states is located in Emil, Alabama, which its population at the time was more than almost 80% African American. And then, so in this study, they concluded that indeed race was the best indicator, even when they adjusted for income, that that where toxic waste is going to be located. And this study, the 1987, was revisited 20 years later in 2007, and they reached the same conclusion. Actually, I think it was toxic waste race at 20, which looked at from 1987 to 2007. The report confirms that indeed there is association between race and facility siting, and that evidence clearly confirms the existing one. And unfortunately, it's unfortunate, but that's again pointing that even though maybe some people think it's economic and it's income, but race is the best still indicator. And there was a recent study called Linking Toxic Outlayers to Environmental Justice Community that was done by Mary B. Collins and Ian Muniz, and that was published in 2016, that in the journal Environmental Research Letters, that indeed said that what we have is the super polluters. Those are the polluters that are most responsible for over 90% of toxic emission, and those constitute really 5% of industrial polluters. And if you look at them, based on this study, these 5%, the most, the super polluters tend to cluster in low income and minority communities. And they term this double disproportionality that the communities of color are facing. And there was another study that was done because we always have this argument from people, well, the facilities were there and the community went there and lived there, or chicken or egg first, who came first, people or pollution? And then that was a study that Professor Paul Mohai from University of Michigan did the study, and he showed that that's not true, that indeed, in most cases, people were there and pollution followed rather than the other way around. And that also was published in Environmental Research Letters.
What are some of the, so a long, extensive history of demonstrating that race is a bigger indicator than socioeconomic status, and that, in fact, it is these communities that were there first, with industry and also and other super polluters kind of coming in, and taking advantage of these communities. What are some we know for instance that COVID has disproportionately affected communities of color. Is this also an environmental justice issue?
Definitely. Before I talk about that, I also wanted to briefly talk about another aspect that I know that since 70s, if you look at it, the quality of environment has improved because of the existing regulation and also, but what we also see in these communities are the fact that existing laws are not enforced equally across. And there was a study in 1992 by the National Law Journal that dubbed the unequal protection, because when they looked at the enforcement action, they concluded that indeed what they saw was that even existing laws are not enforced equally. And they said that when the report narrates the double standards and differential treatment and discrimination that is embedded in enforcement action, and then when you fast forward to 2012, you see there is a study that was done by Dr. Bullard and Dr. Wright. They call them the godfather of environmental justice and godmother of environmental justice. The book was published, The Wrong Complexion for Protection, where they looked at 80 years of disaster response from 1927 Mississippi River flood to Hurricane Katrina and the BP oil in 2010. And they found out that the government responses tend to be slower. And the government tend to respond to slower in the when disaster comes in the communities of color. That's why they put it there. And then fast forward to COVID, we see that indeed, before even the data as incomplete as it is today, because it took New York Times Freedom of Information Act to get CDC to release some of that information a few days ago, the information that with CDC on race. So even before those incomplete data emerge, any of us that were engaged within environmental justice movement would have told anybody that there will be clusters in those communities with high incident of COVID if there is exposure there. Because if you look at the level of pollution, we see that there was a study that Harvard just did in, was it in April, that they looked at just one single pollutant, and that was the particulate matter 2.5. And they said that if people who have been exposed to PM 2.5 tend to die more likely than people who were not exposed.
From COVID?
From COVID, yes.
Okay.
And that was a recent study to look at the comorbidity factors. Mm-hmm. And they found that people who were exposed to particulate matter tend to have higher fatality. And again, we knew that because even though many of these communities are suffering, because PM 2.5 causes a hypertension, prolonged exposure to this. And if you look at that, you will see that there are a lot of pre-existing condition that are brought by those environmental racism. So that's why many of us, before even data came, I think one of the first alarm was by ProPublica when they looked at the fatality, but still that data is incomplete because they are, for every pandemic, I think CDC, that's one of the guidelines, they keep the data on race, but on this one, it seems like it's not emerging as it should. And as I said, it took court action to get that part of it released a few days ago by CDC. So I think also the data is underestimated because we see that many people who die in their homes because they were turned away from the hospital may not make it to that statistic. So, and then put another layer to that. In March, President Trump's administration eased the enforcement and compliance with the existing environmental laws and said that could because of COVID, there is a problem for industry to meet the federal standard and comply. So we leave it at the level of voluntary compliance. And that's another slap in the face of EJ communities that, now we won't even enforce the laws. And that is on top of 95 laws, regulation status that has been there was a rollback or stopped or different ways that was in an article at New York Times about it.
Okay, we're going to take a really quick commercial break, but stay tuned for more in a minute.
I'm Lisa Held, a food journalist and podcast host, presenting Behind the Label with American Humane. Produced by Heritage Radio Network for Springer Mountain Farms, this podcast series dives into what the American Humane Certified Label really means. We're looking inside the farm certification process, beginning with the moment a farmer expresses interest in becoming American Humane Certified, all the way to a consumer seeing the seal on store shelves.
And American Humane is our country's first national humane organization, founded way back in 1877. Now we certify nearly 1 billion farm animals each and every year. Despite that growth, roughly 90% of U.S. farm animals are still raised without the benefit of independently verified science-based standards.
Subscribe to Behind the Label with American Humane wherever you listen to podcasts.
And we're back on Eating Matters, where today I am talking with Dr. Fatima Sheffi from Spelman College, who is an environmental justice expert. So can you talk about the importance of data collection within the context of environmental justice?
Well, I think that we need those kind of data. And what I like is not just data collection for historical purposes, because we have the history of atrocities that are being a long history, written history of atrocities that have been committed against people of color. But what I like to see is real time data where it could be used for intervention that would help us direct resources and design policies to address the need. But currently, as you can see, the data even for COVID fatality is not complete. It took New York Times, New York Times had to go to court to get that data partially just a few days ago to get the data based on that had race in it. So it is
and COVID.
And CDC just released it. It was, I think, Friday that article came in New York Times.
Yeah, the administration loves delivering terrible news on Fridays.
Yeah, I think that's interesting.
On purpose, yeah. Is there something that makes kind of data collection when thinking about environmental justice issues particularly difficult?
Well, one of the things that we see that with COVID that we have been talking about before, that it was hard to see to really have the data in your face the way we see with COVID, the disproportionality of COVID, because we know that there is a delay between exposure to hazardous chemical and then the appearance of the disease. It generally takes a few years before you get exposed to a non-carcinogen till you have cancer. And it has been, our regulatory system is really not geared to that. The only one that I recall that we established the correlation was in a community was when we look at the PCB in Anniston, Alabama, that ATSDR, the Agency for Toxic Release and Disease Registry, which is part of the CDC, they did a study and they showed the correlation between what they saw in Anniston, Alabama in the population and then exposure to PCB that was there. And also we know about asbestos. Those are the very rare cases where you have, that kind of correlation. As such, many of these community members that are exposed to these toxic material, whether in their air or in their water, in their soil, but our study and the way we analyze the study doesn't show that. We have, like, if you look at the area between Baton Rouge and New Orleans that has the dubious name of Cancer Alley, there are clusters of cancer. But then we don't have study that directly correlates that cancer with PCB or others. Why? Because we treat chemicals like innocent until proven guilty. And then we also tend to treat people like canaries in mine. And then if you look at that, you will see that we, when we regulate, the U.S. regulate the chemical, they are studied just one at a time in silo. So we really don't know what is the synergistic impact of chemical when they are combined with another chemical. Because as we know, we breathe the air, it's not really compartmentalized in a way that this chemical goes to this section of air, that chemical. So there is a cumulative impact, and which is really the gist of what the community are saying, is that we really are not exposed to just one chemical and for a short time, but it is a cumulative impact of being exposed to all these chemical that need to be taken into consideration. So that's why we need data. We did a little bit better after the Bhopal disaster in 1984. Congress created the toxic release inventory, which was a great tool for the community right to know, because you can really put your zip code and see what is being emitted in your community. If you put your zip code in the toxic release inventory, you can see what is emitted in your air, water, soil, and who is the which company is doing it. And that really encouraged the industry to be careful and reduce their waste. But we have also manipulated that data, because we change sometimes the threshold reporting to make it look better. That is, again, another political game. But that was a good start. And then the National Environmental Organization, like Environmental Defense Fund, created a scoreboard that you could go and put your zip code and find out what's going on in your. But data is critical. But data should really be put into context, because without context, wrong conclusion can be drawn from the data. Like if you just say African American are disproportionately dying from COVID, then if you don't put it in the context, someone may conclude that maybe they are biologically prone to die.
Right.
And so that's why data, without really the context of data, is also can be a dangerous tool.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that actually happened. I mean, earlier, like I think it maybe in June, the U.S. Surgeon General essentially blamed the drinking and smoking habits of African Americans and Latinos for contributing to the severity with which they've been hit by COVID. And then also kind of said, well, also the, you know, the burden of social ills is what he said. But I mean, yes. Exactly what you said. I mean, also an example of trying to blame, you know, people for the, and their behaviors for, like, you know, for something that is so clearly, you know, but trying to make it create a scapegoat, and and it was just such an awful thing that he said. But okay, so data collection is quite difficult in with this these issues in particular, and sorely lacking. And is that when you talk about the database, does that also include like the effects of where there are high instances of like asthma, for instance, or, you know, or lead paint and the negative health outcomes from exposure to lead paint? Or is it mostly things like cancer clusters?
I think even in asthma, as you know, is not only that disproportionately impact the African-American children and African-American adult, but also the disproportionate death caused by asthma is there. So another health disparities that, or lead poisoning. I think there was a report that was 2002, that the Secretary of Health submitted to Congress, and it was like 12 times the national average for an area in Chicago. So again, disproportionate lead poisoning among African American children. These are classic in terms of now, okay, it's established. But we have cancer. Yes, the cancer rate is higher for African American, but again, cancer is very, hard to pinpoint. Why? Because again, one is the environmental factor. So there are so many chemicals in use, and especially if you live in St. James Parish in Louisiana, or Mosul, Louisiana, or Pensacola, or you know, some of these communities. I think I saw a data that Deep South Center for Environmental Justice just did that showed that those clusters have also high death rate for COVID-19. So if you overlay those, but the thing is that if we just want the data for the sake of data, it's useless. We should use the data to really design our intervention, because there is no shortage of data in terms of our history about racism and what this racism did to Native Americans, to Blacks, to Latinx. What we need is real-time data. That how can we, you know, allocate resources? How can we have policies to address these issues? And that is critical.
Yes, and we're going to talk about some solutions a little bit later in the show. But before we kind of move on, I want to ask, are there impacts beyond negative health outcomes that result from these, environmental racist policies and our reality?
Well, environmental racism, if you look at the way that environmental justice defines environment, as I was trying to say in the beginning, that when we go to that holistic definition of environment, when we talk about environment not just as a, somewhere we go and have picnic, but more like where we work, where we live, where we play, where we study, where we, what, where, and how we eat, then you can see that the impact is much broader than just a sighting of the facilities. Look at the food, desert food swamp, the access to healthy and fresh fruit and vegetable. It's really a challenge if you look at some of these communities that you see that there aren't that many grocery stores that are there. And the people have to also, the issue of green space is another issue where people can, and the minute they really address some of these issues, then the development comes with the displacement or gentrification. Mm-hmm. So it's really not just about environment. It's about jobs. It's about health. It's about economic well-being. Because a lot of time these industries go to this community and they say we bring jobs, But at the end of the job, at the end of the day, we see that very few jobs are created. Most of the jobs, high-paying jobs, are really for people who are who live outside of these communities, and only some of the very minimum, you know, low-paying jobs. That one, not much of them finds its way in the community. So,
and what about like the housing component?
The housing component, you see that a part of, most Americans look at their house as a financial investment. But if your house is located where you have, if you are in Chester in Pennsylvania, if you are in Mosul, Louisiana, if you're, I mean, your house is not going to appreciate. And so, so that is an economic loss. And a lot of times you tend to also not get the response from authority. I think Flint, one of the thing about Flint was that it really brought it to the national attention, the environmental justice. And everybody was telling me, oh my God, how could I? I said, well, Flint is not an outlier. Flint is really a norm. And they were dismissed. These communities were talking about their water, but they continuously, their complaints were dismissed as, oh, they are always complaining. They are always complaining. And the toll of Flint is not what happened in the last few years, but it is a, its toll will be known in a few years, because we will see that all those lead that we pumped in those children's body is going to come back to haunt us and haunt those children's life.
You have said that where you live maps your vulnerability. Can you tell us more about what you mean?
Well, where you live is really, as Dr. Bullard said, its zip code should be an address, not an indicator of people's health. And what happens if it's a, one of the best predictor of your health, economic and social being, is the, your zip code. It can, by your zip code, people can predict your life expectancy, the quality of your life, and your economic well-being. And that is really a sad statement, because zip code should remain an address. And I think that if you look at the legacy of redlining, even though it is illegal, but if you look at the housing, even today, I think we see the remnants of that redlining that have put people of color in a much vulnerable geographical position than other demography.
What is, you also, I've heard you use the term adaptation apartheid. Can you tell us more about that as well?
Well, when we talk about climate change, the climate change was caused, is caused by human and the greenhouse gases that human have generated. But if you look at the, you know, the footprint of many of these communities of color, you see they have a very small footprint when it comes to greenhouse gases. Yet, if you look at the vulnerability, you see that climate change exacerbates the existing vulnerabilities. What it does, it like, these communities really don't have the means to either invest in adaptation or mitigation. And look at now, with COVID. Before even COVID, when the heat comes, who has the air condition when the heat waves come? Wealthy people. When hurricane comes, you know, who stayed behind in Louisiana, New Orleans? The people who didn't have the car. And then that is what Desmond Tutu calls adaptation apartheid, that the disparity in the ability to really have those resources to invest in mitigation, in adaptation, in resilience, we see that is missing. And we saw the devastation that Hurricane Katrina inflicted on blacks in New Orleans. And many of them have never gotten a chance to go back because some of the properties have become so expensive because there was no policy in place to ensure that they get back to their homes. So
that is like what you mentioned earlier in the program, gentrification.
Yes.
And that's an example of another issue that is caused.
Yes.
So I want to talk a little bit about your personal experience in this space. This is something you've dedicated your life's work to doing. What initially drew you to the environmental justice field?
Well, as a child, I loved always environment. I loved to go out and enjoy. And when I was a graduate student, what happened was that the Union Carbide disaster happened in Bhopal, India. And to this day, it has the dubious extension as the worst industrial accident. However, I really try to not use the word accident because the company audit highlighted the problem that existed in the plant 2 years before that fateful night in December 1984, that the runaway reaction is going to happen if these precautions are not taken and these issues are not addressed. And then when it happened, I decided to use it for my as a case study for my dissertation. And the deeper I looked at, the more I realized that the very people who really benefited the least from the plant, the Union Carbide plant, were the one that paid the highest price. To this day, the data is disputed. In the grassroots people put the death toll as 10,000. The government put it as 3,000. But the different document like the registry for morgues and other indicator shows that the grassroots people were closer to the truth. And then we really, the community had no idea what was being manufactured in that plant. So a lot of community people run toward the plant to rescue the plant because all they knew that it was manufacturing fruit medicine and how dangerous that could be. And so they went toward the plant and they lay dead. And the company refused to disclose what was in the air that was the gas that was released. To this day, we don't know the composition of that gas. And even as people were dying in the hospital on the way to the hospital, the company kept saying that MIC, methyl isocyanate, was an eye irritant and not fatal. And by the time they came up with saying that, oh, it could potentially cause that, all the rich people in the city immediately when the accident happened, the release happened, they fled the city. They got into their cars and left. Mm-hmm. And so it was the hospital that was there and the poor people who were running to the hospital or to the plant. And that
initially, you know, sparked your, made you really want to work on these issues, that incident?
Yes. And my conclusion from that case was that environmental degradation follows the path of least resistance. And that is what I thought was, you know, and then eventually we that's why I was attracted to environmental racism and environmental justice movement.
Can you tell us more kind of about your work? So you, in addition to being, you know, like on the ground working on these issues, you're also an educator. So you work at university and you have taught extensively on this subject. Can you tell us a little bit more about the work that you've done over the years, both in the classroom and in academia and, you know, working with a variety of organizations and the government?
Yes, I feel that this solution is in policies and implementation of those policies. So, and in order to really bring change to policy, I feel like we need people informed so they can push for a change in the policy. So I tried to create courses. So I created a course on environmental policy and politics at Spelman. And then I also had piloted course on environmental racism. I also worked with my colleagues and we established environmental studies minor and environmental studies major at Spelman College. And they also have, we have a very strong environmental science program too. Beyond that, I also try to go after the educators like myself, because I thought that that might be a good way of incorporating or greening of the curriculum. So in 1994, 1995, and 1998, 1999, and 2001, I had a summer institute, environmental summer institute for high school and middle school teachers that were funded. The first 2 years I co-PI'd with my colleague, Dr. Bob Holmes at CAU, and the last three, it was me, that I got funding from US EPA and trained the high school and middle school teachers on the greening of the curriculum. And I took them to trips to Anniston, Alabama. At the time, that was a very active case, so they could look at the PCB and where the how it is mapped. And then subsequently, I got a grant from UNCF and EPA and conducted workshop for a faculty at HBCUs and MI institutions where we would have like 2-3 days of workshop and helping them green their curriculum, because that is where is critical to get students to see the environment, not in a very narrow sense of where you go for picnic or it's about polar bear or spotted owl, but to see themselves really as this, the environment is where we breathe and where we live and where we work. So that is what I have done. And then when I was appointed by, at the time, EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson to serve on National Environmental Justice Advisory Council, that was very rewarding experience, trying to really be very close to environmental policy. And then, of course, I was also asked by CDC when they were embarking on the Healthy Housing Initiative by Lead Poisoning Branch. They wanted an environmental justice lens, and I was happy to work with them, because every time these opportunities come, I say, okay, now it's time to just move the needle, even if it is just barely, but still it moves.
Yeah. Okay, so that's a perfect segue to solutions. What branch of the government is responsible for oversight, or is the most responsible for oversight? And also, is it, you know, what do you, where do you see the most kind of like action? Is it at the state level, the local level, the federal level?
Okay. I think that if you look at the agency that really is authorized to address environment, then EPA comes to mind immediately. Of course, it is other issues, because as I said, environmental justice movement is really about not just environment, but also civil rights, about social and economic justice issues. But if you look at the EPA, and you will see that, first of all, to this day, we really don't have any environmental policy. And the only thing I know, in 1992, there was a bill that was introduced by then Senator Al Gore and Representative John Lewis to address environmental justice. It never really took, it never went anywhere. So the closest national policy was the executive order that was issued by President Clinton, 18-12898, that addressed all the federal agents, I mean, 17 federal. It was later President Obama that expanded it to all federal agencies. And what it did, it really didn't create an environmental law, but it made use of two existing laws. One, it resurrected the environmental impact statement of the NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, which to this date is the most comprehensive environmental law that was ever passed by U.S. Congress, and then the Title VI of the civil rights law that says any federal funding cannot be used for if they are discriminating. So these are the, but currently I was so encouraged because there is a report that just was published by the I'm sorry, by the House Climate Select Committee that was on the climate crisis, and was released in June 30th of this year. And I'm happy to report that indeed there is a part of this report that is devoted to environmental injustices in the United States, where it really talks about environmental justice as a way of, just mentioning it is a big deal for us because we have not had that. So this Solving the Climate Crisis report that was issued by the Select Committee on Environmental Crisis, the Pillar 6 of this talks about environmental justice, where it talks about investing in disproportionate exposed community in order to cut pollution and advance environmental justice. It has different elements, put EJ at the center of climate and environment policy. And it's also directing EPA to consider cumulative impact that I was talking about. And because we have never done the cumulative impact of industrial facilities in these EJ community. And then enforcement, strengthen enforcement of environmental law, which I talked about it. I said unequal protection of law. And then which in 1982 of National Law Journal and the 2012 book of Wrong Complexion for Protection. And so it's really I'm very delighted to see that finally EJ is finding its way into the law. I know that it is not there. I'm just excited because it is just proposed by the House, and it is in the form of report. But I'm hoping, because there are good signs that are coming, because last year in 2019, I witnessed the first convening of the EJ stakeholders that was put together by Chairman Raul Grijalva and by Representative Donald McKitchen. So that was, and then they had town hall meeting, Tula town hall meeting, virtual town hall meeting recently. So these are good signs, but policy can do magic. If you look at the Spartanburg in South Carolina and see how it was transformed from a community where there was really despair, boarded houses, inundated with landfill, with and then when the community got engaged and lawmakers and leaders were willing to listen, and then an activist, which was Harold Mitchell, started when he noticed all this cancer in his own family. And then he digged, and then he realized that they were living next to a pesticide plant, and then got it to EPA, and then eventually got $25,000 small grant from EPA. And from there, he built it into $200 million and then transformed the community. He ran and was elected to serve in the South Carolina's House, and the whole community was transformed from, as Mustafa Ali says, from surviving to thriving. That you have now community health center, you have green space, you have jobs, you have healthy housing that is there. So it is possible, and it is in our best interest to really invest in that transformation.
That is such a wonderful story, and I would love to leave it on a happy, optimistic note, because you know I don't have a lot of those these days with our current state of affairs. But before we totally wrap up, I just have two quick questions for you. Maybe not so quick, but number one, what are some key resources you would recommend to our listeners who want to continue learning about this subject?
Well, the good thing about now that if you Google, just put environmental justice, and you will see a lot of information comes. And that is really one of the things that the environmental justice movement has done. Because if you would have done that in 80s or early 90s, barely anything. I think the first book that came out was Dumping in the Dixie by Dr. Bullard in 90. That was, but now you can get a lot of information on that. So I would say that is a good start. And there are reports on the National Environmental Justice Advisory Council that they can look. There is a report on Flint. There are reports on youth perspective on climate change. There are many reports there that they can look and see. There is a Deep South mm-hmm. Center for Environmental Justice that they do with collaboration with the with Dr. Bullard from Texas Southern. They do a environmental climate HBCU student climate change conference each year. And then the website of Dr. Bullard that has articles about environmental justice.
And what for our individual, for our listeners who want to make a contribution on the individual level, you know, through their own actions, beyond educating themselves, what would you recommend that they do?
I would say get engaged. Write letter to your representative, show that you care, because when the Black Lives Matters echoed, "I can't breathe," that resonated mm-hmm. with all the environmental justice people, because we could tell you that many of these people in these communities, maybe they were not on the spotlight, but they have problem breathing because of what yeah. where they live. So that's get involved. If you can't participate, just write a letter. Make sure that your views are heard. Educate your neighbor, educate your friend that this is a real movement, that indeed it's not, it is, as I said, it's a civil rights movement. Because I know that we don't traditionally cover air breathing, you know, as part of our civil rights, but we are entitled to have access to clean air to breathe, to clean water to drink, to live where it's not, where it would not really make us unhealthy. Because many of these problems are really place-based problem that, as you can see with asthma, with lead. During the 1996 Olympic, when they restricted the traffic in part of Atlanta, there was 40% reduction in asthma emergency visit.
Wow.
So the data is there. There is no shortage of data. If you look at the data, you will see that it's there. It's just how can we operationalize that data into real policy?
Well, that is, we're going to have to leave it there, but I want to thank you so much for coming on the show. You are, for your life's work, you are so brilliant, and I'm really lucky to have had the experience of chatting with you today.
Well, thank you for the invitation. I really want to spread the word that, you know, that we really need to address that. It's not just in the interest of our community, but all of us, because we all live in the same planet. We share the same planet. Mm.
Yeah.
And thank you for allowing me to share.
One quick clarification to this episode before we wrap up. When we were previously talking about how COVID disproportionately affects community of color, Fatima meant to reference Escambia County in Florida and not just Pensacola, Florida, which is actually located within Escambia County. And we're going to leave it there. I want to thank our sponsors for their generous support, as well as our show engineer, Jeet Paul.
All episodes of Eating Matters are available on the Heritage Radio Network website or as a podcast wherever you find them. I'm Jenna Lee Ute, and thanks for listening. Eating Matters is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right-hand side of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.